Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, we come back then to the life of Abraham and Sarah again this evening, and here we have then that couple, as we've seen them already, come through some of the trials and vicissitudes of life, wherein their own faith and their own confidence in God has gone up and down in the Bible record. There's something very true, isn't there, about the story of this couple, that the Bible paints their characteristics unmercifully. When they're doing well, the Bible says so. When they're failing, the Bible also records that. And so what we've found, of course, already in our studies is that the story of this couple is the story of ups and downs in the truth. And yet somehow I think that's useful and important for us to know, because remember how we said at the start that quite often Bible characters tend to be, well, sort of cardboard characters. They're somebody different somehow to us. And somehow when we think of Abraham and Sarah, we tend to imagine a couple that are way up there, so high, so inaccessible that we could never hope to be like them. And yet when we come to the divine record about their lives, we find in fact they're not really like that at all. We find that really there is a couple that have all the problems associated with daily life that we experience ourselves. Remember in Genesis chapter 12, how Abraham made a mistake under the pressure of famine, took his whole family to Egypt, then realized that he was in trouble and compromised himself further, threw his wife into the gravest of difficulties by allowing her to be taken into Pharaoh's household. And it was only Sarah's marvelous submission to her husband that saved the day and called down the divine response whereby the house of Pharaoh was plagued for Sarai, Abram's wife, says the record in Genesis chapter 12. And then we remember the story of Genesis chapter 16 and the way in which the roles were reversed, and then Sarah makes a mistake. And it's Sarah that has a problem of barrenness growing so huge in her mind that she wants to take over the running of the family. She wants to take over from God. And she suggests that awful suggestion that Hagar be given to Abram to wife in order that children might be brought forth to Sarah. And we see again in that chapter the failing of Abraham, how he really ought to have exercised a wiser headship in the household and suggested to his wife why that wasn't a good idea, and suggested to her that this was something that they could work through together. But no, Abraham himself is not fully developed at this stage, and so he makes the mistake of listening to the voice of his wife and not perceiving what was wise and what was not wise in life. Although, as we read in the story of that chapter, of course, at least he had the tact and the sensitivity at a time when she was wrought up emotionally to handle her delicately and thoughtfully, so that in fact she did deal righteously with Hagar, her handmaid. So you see, this is going to be the story of ups and downs in the life of this couple. And what we find to our surprise is they were really very ordinary after all. They had coughs and colds, they had headaches, and they had hot nights, and they had burnt meals. They had all the things that are associated with the cares and problems of daily life ourselves. Went through all of those things. They're a real couple, brothers and sisters. We want to look at them and see them as a real couple, to see the real problems that they worked through, and to take encouragement from the fact that as they grew in life and the truth, so also can we. Well, we're going to look at chapter 17 this evening. We probably haven't got time to look at the whole of the chapter, but we hope, God willing, to at least get through some of the major parts of the chapter that bear particular relationship to the couple that we're looking at. You'll notice in chapter 17 and verse 1, the record says, "And when Abram was 90 years old and nine." Now, remember that the last verse of the previous chapter tells us that Abraham was 86 years old. So he's 86 at the end of chapter 16, but he's 99 at the start of the next verse in chapter 17. So 13 years have gone by. And in that time, there has apparently been no revelation from God concerning the promised seed to come. And you know, I believe that Abram and Sarah learnt particularly two things, in those 13 years. The first thing they learnt was the absolute need to wait on God. And they had to do that. to wait on God to fulfil the promise in his good time, and more importantly, in God's own way. And you know that later on in the divine record, we're going to be told by the Apostle Paul in Hebrews 6 and verse 15, and so after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. And here in this chapter was going to be part of the outworking of that patient spirit of endurance, whereby for 13 years they'd had to wait now on the Father for further revelation in this matter. And you know what else happened in that same 13 years? In that same 13 years, a little boy was born. Ishmael by name. And his mother walked around the encampment of Abraham with a smile on her face. Especially every time she caught sight of Sarah. Patting her little boy on the head and saying how well he was getting on. And how fond Abram was of him. And Sarah had to learn in those 13 years to live with the consequences of her foolish actions in the previous chapter. And it must have hurt, must have stung. But now at last, after that long period of time, when Abram was 90 years old and 9, says the record, the Lord appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be thou perfect. Now, Almighty God, of course, here is the title El Shaddai. A title which can be both one of comfort or of warning, depending on the derivation of the word. And so it's been deemed, of course, that the root word for Shaddai can either mean that which nourishes and sustains or that which destroys. And so because there are two alternate tracks, if you like, linguistically that we could go down, then we must use the context to determine which of those two ideas contextually is appropriate for El Shaddai in this place. And undoubtedly we believe that the force of El Shaddai in Genesis 17 and verse 1 is the idea of he who is able to nourish up, he who is able to make fruitful. Let's just have a look at a couple of references in that regard. A little later on in Genesis chapter 28. In Genesis 28 we have, of course, later on in the life of Isaac and his charge to Jacob, these words in Genesis 28 and verse 3. Now look at the spirit of El Shaddai here. And God Almighty, Genesis 28 verse 3, God Almighty bless thee and make thee fruitful and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people. So you see, the spirit here of El Shaddai is the spirit of the God who is able to nourish up in order that a young family might be brought forth. El Shaddai is the spirit, as it were, of a nursing father. Come and have a look at chapter 43 of Genesis, while we're still in Genesis. Genesis chapter 43. And having got to Genesis 43, that's not the one I want. It's actually Genesis 49. Genesis 49 and verse 25. So in Genesis 49, at the end of the words of Jacob, we read, even by the God of thy father who shall help thee, and by the Almighty Shaddai, who shall bless thee with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lieth under, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. So who provides the blessing of the nursing mother and of the bearing mother but El Shaddai, he who is a nursing father to his people, he who's able to make the nation fruitful and to cause them to bring forth. In the New Testament we have the same spirit, don't we, in the 2nd of Corinthians in chapter 6. Perhaps just this one New Testament reference concerning the spirit of El Shaddai. And here contextually is of course the spirit of the title in Genesis 17, we believe as well. So in the 2nd of Corinthians and in chapter 6 we read, reading the last two verses, 2 Corinthians 6, 17 and 18. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and I will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. So here, if you like, is a New Testament form of El Shaddai, and in the context of God being a father to sons and to daughters. So you see, when in Genesis chapter 17 and verse 1, God appears before Abram and says, I'm El Shaddai, the one who really appeared before him was the God who was going to act as a nursing father to develop up the young family here of Abraham, the first seed out of which would be developed the whole household of Israel. Yahweh, and the name Yahweh, was going to have more application to the covenant God of the fully developed seed later on. But now we're only at the beginnings of the family. We're only at the laying of the foundation seed. And what was needed was the nourishment of El Shaddai, the nursing father who's able to provide the blessings of fruitfulness and multiplication. And so it's El Shaddai then, in Genesis chapter 17 and verse 1, who appears before Abram on this occasion. You notice how Genesis 17 verse 1 finishes at the end of the verse. Walk before me and be thou perfect, says the phrase. Be thou perfect. Now, of course, the word perfect here doesn't mean to be sinless. It means to be upright or to be sincere. And really that ought to ring a bell with us in terms of a Bible echo. Who was the man who walked before God and who was perfect in all his generations? Well, who was it? I'm sure one of the children can tell us that, because why, we should have done that in our lessons already in stage one. What man walked before God and was perfect in all his generations? Can anyone tell me that? It was Noah, wasn't it? That's right. The fullness of the phrase is Noah. Noah walked before God, Genesis 6, and was perfect in all his generations. And you know what God did with Noah? God made a new beginning with the whole world through Noah and his sons. And that's exactly what God is about to do with Abram. And if Abram had known the story of Noah, his mind would have flashed back to that earlier man who also was perfect in his walking before God, of whom God had taken he and his sons to make a new beginning in the world. And now God's is about to do exactly the same thing with Abram himself. Walk before me and be thou perfect, he says in Genesis chapter 17 and verse 1. And then he says verse 2, and I will make my covenant between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly. I will make my covenant, says the phrase. And the word make is not the word bereth, meaning to cut a covenant. It's actually the word nathan, to constitute or to grant a covenant. So you see, the covenant's already been made in Genesis 15. Remember the sacrifices and the cutting of the covenant? So the covenant is cut in Genesis chapter 15, but it's now about to be implemented in Genesis 17. So God says, look, the time has now come for me to fulfill the covenant. I'm not going to bear it again. I'm not going to cut it again. I'm going to nathan it. I'm going to give it. I'm going to grant it. I'm going to bring now the covenant forth, is the promise of God on this occasion. And you see what he does say in Genesis 17 verse 2. I will make my covenant between me and thee. Now you see how that's obviously a theme idea in this section. You notice it again in verse 4. As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee. Actually, I didn't read that very well. As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee. So, me and thee. Again in verse 7, I will establish my covenant between me and thee. Again in verse 10, this is my covenant which ye shall keep between me and you. Again in verse 11, at the end of the verse, it shall be a token of the covenant betwixt me and you. So there's obviously a key idea here. And you see, I don't think that God was meaning that here was a covenant to be made between Abraham and God. I don't think he was just simply saying, well, here's a covenant, Abraham, between you and me. I think what he's saying is that God was going to be personally involved in the fulfillment and the outworking of this covenant. That's what he's saying. It's between you and me, Abraham. And in some special sense, God himself was to be involved in the making of this covenant. And the fatherhood of Abraham, which is going to be brought forth in this chapter, was finally going to be eclipsed by the very fatherhood of God himself. Remember Ephesians 3 verses 14 and 15 when Paul says, he calls down concerning God, in whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. And here now is the father of all the divine family, the father of all, the father himself. And he says to Abraham, it's going to be between you and me, Abraham. We're going to do this thing together. We're both going to be the father to bring forth this seed. God was going to be involved in this way, and he was going to multiply the exceedingly, says the second verse, was the promise of God to Abram. And so verse 3 says, and Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him. He fell on his face. Why do you think Abram fell on his face? Well, obviously it was an expression here, wasn't it, of his reverence before God, and of his humility, and of the deep sense of unworthiness that Abram felt, that God would still move to fulfill this promise after all the mistakes they'd made. I'm sure that Abram felt that. That here they'd made all these mistakes, blundering into all sorts of situations which they really ought not. And now God has come and said, look, Abram, we're really going to do it. You and me together, we're going to fulfill this covenant. Abram fell flat on his face. He didn't feel worthy of the wonder of what God was about to bring forth before him. And God talked with him, says the record. You notice in verse 22, and he left off talking with him, and God went up from Abram. This was a manifestation of angelic discussion. There was obviously an angel came and spoke to him. Elohim came down. Elohim went up from talking with Abram. Something very special and direct about this particular conversation. Well, the promise says in verse 4, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. The margin, by the way, is probably about right. Thou shalt be a father of a multitude of nations. Now, the phrase multitude of nations is something obviously wider than the 12 tribes, although some people have endeavoured to make it just that. That the multitude of nations is in fact the 12 tribes, many little nations within a nation, that is the 12 tribes themselves. But the word for nations that's used here is the word goyim. And goyim, of course, is generally used in the Old Testament about the Gentiles. Not always so, but on most occasions, goyim is used of the Gentiles. And we certainly believe that that's the force of this particular verse. A father of many nations, he was truly going to become, was Abraham, the father of all nations of the earth. And why would that be so? And the answer is because God, remember, says, I'm in this together with you. I'm also going to be responsible and participate in this matter of fatherhood. And because God is the creator of all things, well, God's salvation is universal, isn't it? And so, of course, it had to extend ultimately to embrace all nations, because God himself was to be involved in this matter of fatherhood. So, therefore, all nations are going to be involved. God's principles are universal. And yet, for all of that, Abraham was to be the channel through whom it would come. You see, verse 4, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. So although God was going to be involved, Abraham himself was to be the channel through whom this particular blessing would be accomplished. Now, wouldn't you fall on your face if God said that to you? That through you, all nations of the earth would receive the channel of divine blessing. Through you! Wouldn't you fall on your face? How do you think Abraham must have felt? So how was it all to be done? Verse 5. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Avraham. For a father of many nations have I made thee. And as the margin quite correctly says, Abraham, a father of a great multitude, is probably as good a translation textually of the phrase as we can get. So what was the change then? What did really happen here? Well, we know what happened. Abram became Abraham. So what's the change? Can anyone tell me? What changed in his name? the fifth letter in the Hebrew alphabet is added. So a chay. That's quite right. How many consonants did Abraham have before the letter was added? Do you know? In the Hebrew, Abram has four consonants. So by adding the hay, or the fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, what it did was it added a fifth consonant to his name. So Abram's name becomes Abraham, and it's now made up of five consonants. And the consonant that has been added is, of course, quite correctly, the fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And, of course, because it's the fifth letter, it also has a numeric value of five, doesn't it? It means five numerically. Chay is five in value. And, of course, we know that the H, or the Hay, is the dominant consonant in the divine name itself. And the changing of this name was all in the context of the bringing forth and the fulfillment to Abraham of the covenant that was to be made. Now, where was that covenant made as far as the sacrifices were concerned? It was made in Genesis chapter 15, wasn't it? Now, we won't turn back, but you might just like to take a note that in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 9, when the sacrifices were mentioned for the ratification of this covenant, guess how many sacrifices there are? Why, five. Five animals were used for the ratification of this particular sacrifice. And this promise that is going to come forth is all in the context of the seed. You see verse 7? I'll establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee. This is about the bringing forth of the seed. You know how many times the word seed is mentioned in this story in Genesis 17? In the bringing forth now of the covenant itself. You know how many times the word seed is mentioned? Why? Five times. And you see, this is going to be a manifestation in Genesis 17, isn't it, of God to Abraham. Do you know that there were a number of different manifestations of divine communication to Abraham? In fact, there were eight of them. There are eight separate incidents in the divine record where God appears to Abraham in some form or another. And you'd never guess what the number was for the manifestation in Genesis 17, would you? Why, this is the fifth time that God has appeared to Abram. So you see, it really is all about the number five, isn't it? So he has a fifth consonant added to his name, which happens to be the fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which happens to have a numerical value of five, in the context of a covenant that was ratified with five sacrifices concerning the seed, which is mentioned five times on the fifth occasion of the manifestation of God to this man. It's all about five, isn't it? It's all about five. Now, what does the number five mean? What does the number five symbolize? Well, it is grace, isn't it? Let's have a look at Romans chapter 4 and take up now the implications of this in terms of the fulfillment of the covenant. So here now, in Romans chapter 4, we have the divine exposition of the Apostle Paul on the meaning of what was going on here in Genesis chapter 17. Romans 4, and reading from verse 13. So in Romans chapter 4 and verse 13, we have Paul's exposition on this particular matter. He says, "For the promise that he should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if they which are of the law be heirs, faith is made void, and the promise made of none effect, because the law worketh wrath, for where no law is, there is no transgression. Therefore it is of faith that it might be by grace," says the apostle, "to the end the promise might be sure to all the seed, not to that only which is of the law, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all, as it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations." He quotes from Genesis 17. So in the very context of expounding the fatherhood of Abraham here in Genesis 17, he says that it was all to come, verse 16, of grace. And that's the force of the addition of five over and over again in the story of Genesis chapter 17, as five is added to the promises, added to Abraham's name. Five is obviously the key idea. And you know what this means, I think, in the story of this chapter? What we're being told is this. You can have all the faith in the world. You can have as much faith as you like. But without God's grace, you cannot be saved. And without God's grace, this covenant could never be fulfilled. It was all to be of God, you see. And Abraham is being reminded of that, isn't he? In the marvellous change of his name here from Abram to Abraham, a father of many nations, says Genesis chapter 17 and verse 5. And then the record goes on to say in the sixth verse, "And I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee." You see how the text reads in verse 6? "And I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee." Verse 7, "And I will establish my covenant." Verse 8, "And I will give unto thee." And it's all going to be of God. You see, God was going to do all of this. Through and through, it was what God would accomplish. "I will, I will, I will, I will." And God now was going to move to bless Abraham, to make him exceeding fruitful, and to bring forth the promised seed for which they had waited so long. You see, when it says at the end of the sixth verse, "kings shall come out of thee," what do you think the kings are? Well, obviously there's a reference here to the royal Davidic line, that ultimately out of Abraham would come forth the royal line of David himself, the royal house of the house of Israel. And within that royal line ultimately would come forth Messiah the Prince. And not only Messiah the Prince, but finally a whole aristocracy of people, the aristocracy or the royalty of the age to come, who all count themselves as related to Abraham. "Kings shall come out of thee," says the promise. And so they would. And a whole royal nation ultimately was to be brought forth out of the loins of Abraham, as this promise was wonderfully outworked over time. And so verse 7 says, "And I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee in their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." You notice that the land is given as an everlasting possession in the 8th verse, and that in verse 7 it is an everlasting covenant. Only an everlasting covenant can give everlasting possession. And Brother Thomas says, and makes a beautiful point in Mystery of the Covenant concerning this, that although the land is promised to the natural seed, to Israel themselves, that they will in a special sense inherit the land forever, even though in their generations they will die because they're mortal. That Israel will live forever throughout the 1,000 years of the kingdom age as a nation. Each individual of the nation will die, but the nation itself is eternal. And they will everlastingly inherit the land, because that's what has been promised to them. An everlasting possession based on an everlasting covenant. And then at the end of verse 8 we read, "And I will be their God." And so the promise to Israel was and always has been the promise of a special fellowship relationship with God that no other nation would ever enjoy. "I will be their God." No other nation could ever claim that. And that phrase later on is going to be built out by means of the addition of another phrase. You want to know what it is? "I will be their God." And what's the other phrase? "They shall be my people." Quite right. And so this is that's the beginning of this phrase, isn't it? This is the very first time it occurs. "I will be their God, and they shall be my people." And you know that phrase, once it begins in the divine record, it starts here in Genesis chapter 7. Do you know where the last time is that phrase finally occurs in the divine record? Come and have a look at Revelation chapter 21. Now here's a good illustration of a golden theme of Bible teaching. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. In Revelation 21 and verse 3, we read in Revelation 21 verse 3, "And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God." You know, that was the promise to Israel in Genesis 17. The promise of a special fellowship with God that only that nation would have. That's the last time it occurs in Revelation 21. Talk about a golden theme. Starts in the first book of the Bible and it runs right through to the very last book of the Bible. So really what Revelation 21 verse 3 is saying, of course, is, would anyone like to make an implication from that? If Revelation 21 says that they shall be his people and God himself shall be with them, who's that talking about in Revelation 21? And the answer is, it's talking about the whole world. It's actually talking about the end of the kingdom age, isn't it, the first few verses of Revelation 21. So the promise of Revelation 21 verse 3 is that at the end of the kingdom age, all the world is Israel. They've all become part of Israel. Because only Israel would ever have that special relationship with God. And for that statement to be made of all the world in Revelation 21 tells us that all the world now has become brought into the Israelitish fold. And so back in Genesis chapter 17 then, we take up the record. Now, look, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to actually skip over verses 9 to 14. Not because they're not important, they are, but because we do want to try and focus more particularly on the lessons of verses 15 to 22, which have a closer relationship with the story of Abram and Sarah, apart from making a couple of comments perhaps about the matter of circumcision, which these verses 9 to 14 talk about. Now, you know, we talk about all sorts of things about circumcision, don't we? We generally say that circumcision means, or it implies, symbolises the cutting off of the flesh. Well, yes, so it does. But it means something very specific to Abraham in this particular story. You see, the promise of this chapter is the promise that finally the seed that they were to wait for so long would finally be brought forth. And in the very chapter which says, finally, you know, God comes to Abram and Sarah in this chapter and says, at last, the son that you've been waiting for is about to come. And in the very context of doing that, he says to Abram, now I want you to be circumcised. Now what did that teach Abram in the context of the story of this child? And what it taught Abram more than anything else was that this child was not to be the product of the flesh. So he's circumcised in order to teach Abram that this child was to be as a result of divine intervention and not according to the natural powers of man. You know, we already know that Sarah is unable to bear at this stage. I believe that what God did in the action of circumcision was he brought Abram to the same level as his wife. So what he says in this chapter is, you're about to have a boy. She can't bear children, and I'm going to make sure that you can't either. So that you both know that when this son is born, it's because I've brought him forth. That's what circumcision meant, particularly to Abraham in the context of this chapter. Now come and have a look just at a couple of New Testament references in that regard and see how that spirit is taken up. Acts chapter 7. That surely must be the overriding theme of circumcision in the context of Genesis chapter 17. Acts 7 is, of course, the speech of Stephen. You see what he says in Acts chapter 7 and verse 8. Now look how the matter of the fatherhood of Abraham here is linked to the idea of circumcision. So Acts 7 verse 8. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision, and so Abram begat Isaac. You know, when a man's been circumcised, he can't beget children at all. But you see the way that Acts 7 puts it. He gave him the covenant of circumcision, and so he begat Isaac. This child, when it did come forth, was to be the product of divine intervention in their lives and not the natural outworking of fleshly powers. Romans chapter 4. Romans 4 again, and this time verses 11 and 12. So Romans 4 verse 11, surely the same teaching here, and he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had yet being uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all them which believe, though they be not circumcised, that righteousness might be imputed unto them also, and the father of circumcision to them who are not of the circumcision only, but who also walk in the steps of that faith of our father Abraham. So verse 11 says, he received the sign of circumcision that he might be a father, says verses 11 and 12. And that's the very time when you can't father a child. And that's what Abraham would have learnt by the principles of circumcision in Genesis 17, is that God was reducing him to the state, as it were, of complete dependence upon God for the bringing forth of that promise. They were going to be in this thing together. Both of them were going to end up being totally dependent on the Father's intervention for the bringing forth of this child. And so we come back to Genesis 17 then, and we take up the spirit of the words that follow on after the story of circumcision is concluded. So in verse 15 of Genesis chapter 17, Genesis 17 verse 15, the record goes on to say, as for Sarai thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. Now I want to show you something interesting, brothers and sisters, about this particular couple. What's the title of this address, by the way? Can anyone remember? Embracing the covenant blessing together. Now have a look at this. Verses 5 and 6 of this chapter is the promise particularly made to Abraham in this regard. Now just look what those verses say as they outline the making of the covenant with this man. First of all, neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham. Secondly, thou shalt be a father of many nations. Thirdly, I'll make thee exceeding fruitful. Fourthly, I'll make nations of thee. And fifthly, kings shall come out of thee. Now that's Genesis chapter 17, verses 5 and 6. Now we come to verses 15 and 16, and we have the promise made concerning Sarah. Now just see how this follows through. So, neither shall thy name be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham. And now of his wife it says, as for thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. So just as Abraham's name was changed, so now is his wife. What's the change to his wife's name? Why, that the same H, the same letter of grace, has been superadded into her name as well. They were both in this thing together. And as it says of Abraham, thou shalt be a father of many nations, so it says in these verses, and she shall be a mother of nations. And as it says of him, I will make thee exceeding fruitful, it says of her, and I will bless her. And if we want to know what it means when God says, I'll bless her, the blessing of God that was going to be resting upon Sarah was that she might become fruitful in order to bring forth children. I will make nations of her was the promise to Abraham, and to Sarah the promise is, and give thee a son also of her. And all the nations that would ever spring from Abraham were to come forth on the foundation of this one son that was to be born of this girl, of this woman, of this wife, of Sarah. From that one son, all those other nations would ultimately come forth. Kings shall come out of thee as the promise to Abraham. And in these verses it says, kings of people shall be of her, embracing the covenant blessing together. They were in this story together, brothers and sisters, absolutely, weren't they? You know, if we ever think that these are the promises to Abraham, and we exclude Sarah, his wife, then we've obviously missed the point of the narrative, because she's brought together in a lovely way there that shows her complete involvement in this matter of covenant together with him. And God, as it were, in these verses, concentrates Abram's attention upon his wife's involvement in the fulfillment of this particular promise. It has been said that Sarai means my princess, and that Sarah
means a princess. And that the significance of the change relates to the fact that whereas she had been Abram's princess, that now she is going to become a royal queen for many, a mother of nations, of whom royalty shall come forth. And so her name is changed to Sarah, because she now will be a princess for many, because of her shall come forth the royal progeny of kings. And so we're told in verse 17, then Abram fell upon his face and laughed. You see in verse 16 when it says, I will bless her and give thee a son also of her. You know, Rotherham translates that first phrase as follows. Just listen to this. Yea, moreover, will give from her to thee a son. You know, it's almost as if Abraham is not even involved in this story. I'll give thee from her to thee a son. Almost as if Abraham is, as it were, the bystander, as God himself moves to intervene in this matter and to bless this woman with a child that would then be given to. It's almost like a virgin birth, isn't it? The seed of the woman, the special operation of God. And one thing that Abraham was to learn in this story and in this chapter was that as regards the matters of salvation and the operation of God's providence, that they were absolute equals in the sight of God. Equal fellow heirs in the matters of salvation. And so verse 17 tells us that Abraham fell upon his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old, and shall Sarah that is 90 years old bear? Isn't it interesting? You know, we're told in verse 3 that Abram fell on his face. He obviously must have got up at some stage to talk with the angel. He no sooner gets up than he's given the promise of Sarah. He falls flat on his face again, says verse 17. He was so overcome at the realization of the involvement now of his wife in this particular promise. And I think that's the thing that flattened him. He'd never ever really understood the extent of Sarah's complete involvement in this particular matter. And remember, as we said the other night, he immediately gives honor to his wife, doesn't he, by giving her new name straight away. Shall Sarah, that is 90 years old, bear? Now, notice the way Abraham involves both of them in what he says in verse 17. You see that? He says, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old, me? And shall Sarah that is 90 years old bear, her? So he mentions the both of them, because that's the thing he's really come to understand in this particular promise. That she is involved alongside him. That the miracle of sonship was to involve a divine visitation upon the two of them, that they were truly in this matter together. Abraham was absolutely overwhelmed by that. We're going to see in a minute how I believe that substantially was the thing that affected Abraham on this occasion. And so he says in verse 18, Abram said unto God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. Now we know what the law of the day was, that under the code of Hammurabi, a slave son was not allowed to be dispossessed. You think that's what Abram was asking for? Was Abraham asking that Ishmael might have the rightful place and not this other son who was to be born? No, I don't think that. I think that Abraham knew that if this promise was to be fulfilled, he knew that Ishmael would be relegated to servant status. If this son really did come forth, then he knew that Ishmael would be, as it were, pushed into second place. And I don't think that he's pleading for Ishmael instead of Isaac. I believe that he's asking God to find some place for Ishmael in God's purpose of things. And isn't that how God replies, verse 20? As for Ishmael, I've heard thee. Behold, I have blessed him. I will make him fruitful. I will multiply him. I will give him 12 princes. I will make him a great nation. But my covenant will I establish with Isaac. So you see, Abraham asks God to care for Ishmael as a result of Isaac coming forth, because he knew he would be displaced in the bringing forth of the son. You see, Abraham always had a care for other people in that way. You know, in the next chapter, in Genesis chapter 18, we find him pleading for God with Lot. He pleads Ishmael's cause here. In the next chapter, he pleads Lot's cause before God. Abraham had a lovely spirit of caring for other people. But do you know what Abraham's problem was? He needed to learn to care for his wife. And God reminds him of that in the next verse. So here he is showing concern for Ishmael. Good spirit though that was. Verse 19, and God said, Sarah, thy wife, shall bear thee a son. Almost, you see, as if God says, look, you think about your wife. You go back to thinking about her and her involvement in this particular promise. And her involvement in the birth of this son is going to be stressed several times in this particular record. And God said, therefore, to Abram, you focus on your wife, because Sarah thy son shall bear thee a son indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him. You know that some people believe that Isaac got his name from the laughter of Sarah in Genesis chapter 18. But that can't be so, can it? Because we know that when Sarah laughed in Genesis 18, she laughed in incredulity and unbelief. I believe that he got his name from the laughter of his father here in Genesis chapter 18. When Abram fell on his face, verse 17, and laughed before Almighty God as the promise of the birth of this child was brought forth to him. And so just as Abraham had laughed at the promise of the birth of this son, so we believe that on that basis, the naming of the boy was called Isaac. Let's just work through that in the record here. So the first thing is this. Did Abraham laugh in belief or in unbelief? Well, Romans chapter 4 is a Bible exposition of the spirit of Abraham in this chapter. Romans 4 is expounding Genesis 17. And Abraham's spirit at the time. And here's what Romans 4 says. Romans 4 says that the attitude of Abraham was, he believed in hope, he staggered not, he was strong in faith, he gave glory to God, he was fully persuaded. That's Romans 4's statement upon the spirit of Abraham expounding Genesis chapter 17. The second thing is that Abraham fell on his face. An instinctive prostration in wonder and thanksgiving rather than that of uncertainty or rejection or doubt. If you're not sure about the promise, you don't fall on your face. A man that falls on his face is a man that's overcome with joy at the fact that that promise is about to be fulfilled. There's no doubts in Abram's mind. Remember, he used the new name of Sarah straight away. Shall Sarah, that is 90 years old, bear? And in Abraham's use of his wife's new name, immediately, he indicated his deep appreciation now that they were to embrace this particular covenant blessing together. That they were to be in the matter of this promise together. We're told in John chapter 8 and verse 56 that Abraham rejoiced to see my day, says Christ. He saw it and was glad. And do you know that in this episode here in Genesis 17, when Abram laughs, we have the only occasion in the record where the patriarch is known to have rejoiced. The only occasion where Abram is known to have rejoiced. And so we believe that the son of promise was to be named Isaac, laughter, in commemoration of Abram's glad acceptance of the divine promise on this occasion. And so the naming of the boy was significant of Abram's attitude of faith on this occasion, that God indeed would move to fulfill this promise between the two of them, both husband and wife together. And so we take up the record then in Genesis chapter 17 and in the 20th verse, where the record says, as for Ishmael, I have heard thee, I have blessed him, I will make him fruitful, I will multiply him exceedingly, 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation, but my covenant will I establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear unto thee, at this set time next year. At this set time, number of translations indicate that it was to be in 12 months' time. Not immediately, not straight away. And one of the reasons why it wasn't to be straight away is because although Abraham believed that these things would happen, it's evident from the record and from particularly the next chapter that Sarah didn't. I believe that when this promise came to Abraham on the occasion of this chapter, that Abraham, his mind leapt ahead, and he believed implicitly that what God had promised he would perform. In fact, that's what Romans 4 says. It says that he was fully persuaded that what God had promised, he was able to perform. Abram believed that. Sarah didn't. Sarah wanted to believe. Oh, she desperately wanted to believe that this son would come. But she couldn't. Not yet. There were certain things in Sarah that were holding her back. And one of the things that Abram was going to have to learn in this matter was care for his wife, that he might develop up her faith and her thinking and her attitude until finally she could believe alongside him. And I believe that one of the lessons that comes out of this whole story was that the time that was set forth for the bearing of this child was now to allow Abraham the opportunity to develop his wife and to show care for her in order that they might both reach sufficient faith for the bringing forth of that child. Now just have a look at this. Remember how in the 1st of Peter and chapter 3, we've seen how that in Peter's exposition upon the experience of wives and their attitude to their husbands with regard to the spirit of submission, that story is drawn out of the life of Abraham and Sarah. Remember, and in particular, the occasion in Genesis 12 when Sarah wonderfully submitted to Abram. Well, have a look at this here. This is the next part of the 1st of Peter chapter 3, and this time it's now talking about husbands. And so the 1st of Peter 3 puts it this way. It says, likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honour unto the wife, as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. Now look, you might just like to turn this reference up, because it's always good to see it in front of us as well as on the screen, isn't it? So let's just turn up the 1st of Peter 3 together, so that we can see it in front of us. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. So 1 Peter 3, verse 7, likewise ye husbands. Remember we made the point that Peter says there's only two things that you've got to do for a successful marriage. Remember what they were? Wives, he says, all you've got to do is remember to exercise submission. Husbands, all you've got to do is learn the virtues of sacrifice. And so here now is Peter's illustration of that principle. Now, where does he get it from? I think he gets it from this particular chapter. Now you stop and think about it. So first of all, Abram was going to learn to manifest the Spirit. See, the thing that Abram's learned in this story, more than anything else, in Genesis chapter 17, was that his wife's in this with him together. He's never really understood that before. They're both going to be blessed. They're really in this together. Well, dwell with them according to knowledge. Dwell with them. You know, it's interesting that we're told in the record of Genesis that Abram shared his tent with Sarah. I'll just give you the quotation for that. It's in the very next chapter of Genesis. So Genesis 17, we're given the promise. In Genesis chapter 18 it says, the Lord appeared to him in the plains of Mamre, and Abram sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. Verse 1, he ran to meet them from the tent door. Verse 2, and Abram, verse 6, hastened into the tent unto Sarah and said, make ready certain things. Verse 9, where's Sarah thy wife? In the tent. Verse 10, and Sarah heard it in the tent door behind him. They were both dwelling in the same tent, says Genesis chapter 18. Interesting little thing. He was sitting in the door of the tent. He sees the strangers. He rushes out. He comes back into the tent. He says, make a meal ready, Sarah. And she sits in the tent door afterwards. They dwell in the same tent. They dwell together, says Genesis chapter 18, in the same tent. It's only a little thing. But that's exactly how the Genesis record shows that this couple lived. They dwelt together. And on what basis? According to knowledge. Abraham was going to have to learn to become considerate of his wife's needs. And do you know that it's interesting that from Genesis chapter 17, when Abram finally realizes that his wife is involved in this promise together, do you know that every single incident from now on, you'll always see Abram showing consideration for Sarah's needs. In every incident from now on, we see that principle. And the lesson that Abram was going to have to learn was to dwell with his wife according to a knowledge of her needs. Giving honour to the wife, he immediately, of course, calls his wife Sarah, gives her new name to him. As unto the weaker vessel, Abraham had sympathy for Sarah's barrenness. And as being heirs together, isn't this the chapter where Abraham now fully appreciates that his wife is to be involved in the outworking of this promise? Heirs together of the grace? Well, that's not too hard, is it? Because isn't that the whole story of Genesis 17? And the adding of divine grace to each of their lives and to each of their names, the adding of the fifth letter to both Abraham and Sarah, and it was to be the grace of life. Now, life in the end, of course, means life eternal, but in the context of this couple originally, the promise of being heirs together of the grace of life was the promise of being physically quickened so that they could have a child. Wasn't that the life-giving force that was promised to this couple in particular? And that your prayers be not hindered. And we read later on in the story that Abram's prayers were indeed going to bring forth faith in Sarah so that that child might be born. So that's, I think, where it comes from. That Abraham out of the story of Genesis 17, we'll just come back to Genesis 17, that Abraham out of the story of Genesis 17, therefore, was going to have to learn to show care and consideration and sacrifice for his wife in these particular matters. Now, I just want to talk about that principle for a moment. I know that I'm pretty well on time now, so I'm going to ask you to bear with me for another 5 minutes so that I can just work my way through this particular matter. You know, we're told in Ephesians chapter 5, aren't we, that husbands ought to love their wives even as Christ loved the Ecclesia and gave himself for it. And you see, I think what happens with a lot of brethren is we all know that we've got to sacrifice for our wives. Wives ought to submit, husbands ought to sacrifice. It's all very simple, isn't it? But somehow, when we look at the example of Christ who loved the Ecclesia and gave himself for it, it all seems so big and so large that husbands don't know where to begin, do they? How do you begin to sacrifice for a wife? Where does it start? Such a big sounding principle, isn't it? Well, you see, I think what Peter does here is Peter breaks the idea of sacrifice into several components, four to be precise, and what Peter's explaining in the first of Peter 3 is, you want to know how to sacrifice for your wives? Says Peter, he says, I'll show you. He says, there's only four things. He says, this is sacrifice broken down. The first thing is, you dwell with them according to knowledge. The second thing is, you learn to give honour to your wife. The third thing is, you appreciate that she's the weaker vessel. And the fourth thing is, you understand that you're truly heirs together of the grace of life. Now that, says Peter, are the four parts of a husband learning sacrifice. He breaks it down to make it simple and easy. And all you've got to do, says Peter, is to practice those things. Well, brethren, we really have to do that. And it's all very well exhorting wives to submission, but husbands have to learn to practice sacrifice. You know, it's a funny thing about men. Because, well, I suppose that we will sacrifice. But the funny thing about men is that they learn the principle of sacrifice for everybody else apart from their wives. You ever notice that? Guilty. You're asked to do a special effort. Oh, yes, of course. Sunday school? No problems. Gospel proclamation work? Good idea. Committee work? Yes, of course, be available. And you have brethren running around doing all sorts of things in ecclesial life, and the one thing they'll never do is spend any time with their wives. A lot of brethren find it very hard to sacrifice for their wives. It's not built into them, naturally. It's built into a wife to sacrifice for her husband and for her family. It's not built into a man. It's not built that way at all. Sometimes husbands run around doing all sorts of things for the truth, but the last thing they'll do is put those principles into practice in their own home. You know, when it says dwell with them according to knowledge, I don't think that means specifically that husbands have to be at home pushing knowledge into their wives. It doesn't mean dwell at home pushing knowledge. What it means is that a husband has got to become knowledgeable of his wife's needs. That's the knowledge that he's got to dwell with them concerning. Now, how does a husband become knowledgeable of his wife's needs? Well, there's lots of little things that go to make up that, of dwelling together according to knowledge, isn't there? What about reading a book together? I won't ask for hands up. How many husbands and wives find the time... How many husbands find the time to make sure that they have opportunity to read a book with their wives, something that's encouraging and helpful in the truth, to read it together, a paragraph each, out loud? What about a nighttime chat at the end of the day to review the day's events, to discuss over life's problems, to overcome any differences that have occurred, to find the time to work those things out, to work them through before you go to bed? And what about evening prayers together? Husbands and wives. Isn't that part of a husband dwelling with his wife according to knowledge? What about Sunday school work with children? There's lots of households where somehow Sunday school work is always mother's responsibility. What about father doing it? In my house, that's one thing I've managed to do, more or less. And every week my children come to me with their Sunday school activities and all the work they've done, and I check it over and we read it through and we change it, and I sign their scholar's diary, signed Father Lewis, that I have seen the work and I'm satisfied. You know, sometimes it's one of the hardest things that I do every week, and it sure feels like a sacrifice. Sometimes wives are very thankful to have a husband that will take the time to dwell with her according to knowledge and to spend time with the children in that way, and not just to leave it to her as if it's all her responsibility. What about giving honour to the wife? You see, giving honour to a wife means learning real respect for her views, wanting to know her opinion on things, seeking for that information. Isn't giving honour part of that principle of old-fashioned courtesy and respect and reverence that was enjoyed 100 years ago, that men really did show a courtesy for women? Isn't that what a husband needs to do even in life today? And I think one of the things about giving honour to wives is no telling offs in public. And public could be in your own home, but where there's visitors present, the wife's done something that the husband disapproves of and gets a telling off. That's not giving honour to a wife, is it? If you've got a problem between the two of you, sort it out in private afterwards. There need be no public dressing down of one another. That's not giving honour. What about understanding the weaker vessel? Appreciating that a wife is built and made differently, that she has a greater sensitivity to things, that sometimes she has deeper emotional feelings, and that husbands have to learn to understand that she's made differently. When it says, by the way, that the wife is a weaker vessel, it doesn't mean that she's inferior intellectually, just that she's made differently. Husbands have to learn to appreciate the physical limits of their wives, that there are times when they become tired. They've got to be able to see that and to understand that and to move in the family when that tiredness comes. And isn't that often the case when a father comes home at night and there's one or two or three or five or six or seven children all running around, and if there's anything that the wife wants, it's that he will just take over that family for a while. Isn't that part of a sacrifice that we make in understanding the weaker vessel, to know that sometimes she sees and feels and thinks about things differently to us? And what about living together as heirs of the grace of life? You know, in the world there are some families that run very much on the principle that the husband makes all the decisions and the wife's never ever consulted. Money matters, she doesn't know a thing. Certain amount dished out each week, that's enough for you. The rest is private for me. That's not really how family life in the truth should be run, is it? In the truth, we're heirs together. Heirs together doesn't mean having secrets. heirs together is all about making mutual decisions concerning life and the family and things to buy and things to do and places to go and how life should be planned. Heirs together. And husbands have got to learn all of those things. They've got to learn that sacrifice isn't bringing a present to the wife, but never helping with the family. Sacrifice isn't taking her for a meal out, but never having prayers together. Sacrifice isn't going on a special holiday, but never having any mutual conversation on the truth. That's not sacrifice. Sacrifice is dwelling according to knowledge. Sacrifice is giving honour to the wife, appreciating her different constitution, and respecting that she's an heir equally in the hope of the truth. And that's what Abraham had to learn for Sarah's sake in this chapter of Genesis 17. And God willing, in our next few studies, we're going to see the way in which Abraham shows that care and that thoughtfulness to his wife, whereby he brings her finally to the triumph of faith that son should be born. Submission, brethren, will be the heartfelt response of any wife whose husband truly lives up to the principles of sacrifice. And whilst it's true that we have problems in society today with the spirit of women's liberation and with those who don't want to conform to the spirit of submission, I think we have a few problems also with regard to brethren learning to sacrifice for their wives and for their families. And in this we can profit from the example of Abraham and Sarah. You see in Genesis 17, just to close in verse 21, he says, "My covenant will I establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time." My covenant. You know, the word covenant is used one time in Genesis chapter 15, when it's first ratified between Abraham and God. And it's then used 13 times in this chapter in Genesis 17. So that when we come to the 21st verse of Genesis 17, that word covenant is being used here now on the 14th occasion. And that's the final one. The 14th occasion that the word covenant occurs concerning this couple. You know what 14 is? Someone like to tell me what 14 is, expressed in another way. It's 7 times 2, isn't it? The covenant, twice. They were in this together, this husband and this wife. You know, Hebrews 11 says that when the patriarchs received the promises, that they didn't receive them, but they confessed and saw them afar off and embraced them. You know, at the time that Hebrews 11 says that they embraced them, he's only talked about two of the patriarchs at that time. He's only talked about Abraham and Sarah up to that point of time in Hebrews 11. Embracing the covenant blessing together. That's the theme of our study from Genesis 17 this night, isn't it, brothers and sisters? As Abraham learnt with wonder of the joy not only of the promised seed to come, but also of his wife's complete and total involvement in that promise. Heirs together they would be, but she's not ready quite yet. Sarah's going to have to be helped to come to that point. And it's Abraham's responsibility to bring her now to the triumph of faith, so that the child of promise can be born.